around Asgard and report on a near movement. Campbell had been furious, accusing Caswellan of amassing a private army. "Can you not understand, Caswellan, that such deeds make war more likely?" said the Hunt Lord. "You think me foolish for trying to forge friendships among the Anir. I know that, as I know they are a warlike people, harsh and cruel. But as Hunt Lord, I must consider the long-term well-being of my people. We could not win a war with the Anir. They would swamp us. What I have tried and will continue to try to do is to make Asbadag aware of the futility of war in the Highlands. We have no gold, no iron. There are no riches here. This he understands. What is more important is that he must feel no threat from us. It is in the Anir nature to see enemies all around. If we can make them our friends, there will be no war." Caswellan listened in silence until Campbell had finished speaking. "Under different circumstances, I would agree with every word, cousin," he said at last. "War is the last beast an intelligent man would let loose. Where I think you are wrong is in believing that the Anir see war as a means to an end. For them, it is the end in itself. They live to fight. They lust for slaughter and blood. Even their religion is based on the glory of combat. They believe that only if they die in battle will their souls be blessed with an eternity of pleasure. Now that their war with the Lowlanders is over, where else can they turn for war save with us? I respect you, cousin. And I mean that truly. You have acted with honour. Yet now is the time to open your eyes and see that your efforts have been in vain. The Anir are massing troops on the southern borders." Campbell shook his head. "Asbadag assures me that the troops are being gathered in order for the majority of them to be disbanded and offered land to farm as a reward for loyal service. You are wrong, Caswellan, and the wisdom of my course will be appreciated in the years to come." Despite Campbell's assurances, Caswellan advised the council to marshal a militia against a spring invasion. They refused, agreeing with the Hunt Lord that there were no indications the Anir nursed any hostile intent towards the clan. The feeling was not unanimous. Bordrig and Leofas supported Caswellan openly. Beric, a tall, balding warrior from the northern valley, voted with them, but said nothing.
"You have 100 men, Caswellan," said Leofas, as the four met after the spring banquet. "I can muster 80 crofters, Bordrick and Beric the same between them. When the Anir come, it will be like a sudden storm. 300 men will not stop them."
"Let us be honest," said Bordrick. "The Farlan united could not stop them. If every man took up his sword and bow, we would have what? 5,000? Against a force 5 times as great?"
Bordrick had changed since the beast killed his son. His hair was grey and he had lost weight, growing haggard and lean.
"That is true," agreed Caswellan, "but we can wear them down. We'll fight no pitched battles. We'll harry them, cutting and running. Soon they'll tire and return to Asgard."
"That will depend on why they're here," said Beric. "If they take the valleys, we'll have no way to support ourselves. We'll die in the mountains come winter."
"Not necessarily," said Caswellan. "But that debate can wait for a better time. What worries me is not the long drawn-out campaign, but the first strike. If they hit the valleys unawares, the slaughter will be horrific."
"There's not a day we do not have a scout watching them,"
said Leofas. "We should get at least an hour's warning."
6 hours march to the east. The crofter Arcus breathed his last. His arms had been nailed to the broad trunk of an oak, and his ribs had been opened, splaying out from his body like tiny, tattered wings. The Blood Eagle had arrived in the Farlan. One Anir army burst upon the villages and crofts of the Hasten.
bringing fire and death into the darkest part of the night. Homes blazed and swords ran with blood. The Aenir swept into the valley of Laric, hacking and slaying, burning and looting. The Hasten had not time to group a defence, and the survivors streamed into the mountains, broken and panic-stricken. A Palades hunter, camped on the hillside inside Hasten territory, watched, stunned, as the Aenir charged into the valley. As if in a dream, he saw the warriors in the garish armour and winged helms race down to the homes of the Hasten, thrusting burning brands through open windows. And he viewed with growing horror the massacre of the clan. He saw women dragged forth, raped and then murdered. He saw babies speared. He saw small pockets of Hasten resistance swallowed up in rings of steel. Then he rose and began to run, stumbling over tree roots and rocks in the darkness. He reached the grey house of Magrig 2 hours before dawn. Within minutes, the war horn of the Palades sounded. Women and children hastily packed clothing and food and were led into the mountains. Thinking there was only one Aenir army, Magrig miscalculated, and the evacuation was still underway as a second Aenir force, led by Ongist, fell upon them. Magrig had 800 warriors at his back, with messengers sent for perhaps 500 more. As he stood on the hillside watching the Aenir pour into the valley, he reckoned their numbers were in excess of 5,000. Beside him, the grim-eyed swordsman Intosh, the game's champion, cursed and spat. The two men exchanged glances. Whatever decision they made now would lead to tragedy. The enemy was sweeping down towards the last file of women and children. If Magrig did nothing, they would die. If the Palades countercharged, they would be cut to pieces. In his heart, Magrig knew it was sensible to leave the stragglers and fight a defensive retreat, protecting the majority. But he was clan, and these stragglers were his people. He lifted his sword, shifted his shield into place, and began to run down the hillside towards the Aenir. 800 Palades warriors followed him without hesitation. Seeing them come, the Aenir turned from the line of women and children. Their deaths would come later. The two forces collided. Swords clashed against iron shields, against close-set mail rings, against soft flesh and brittle bones. The clansmen wore little or no armour, and yet the speed and ferocity of their assault made up for it. Intosh, fighting with two swords and no shield, cut a bloody sway through the Aenir, while Magrig's power and cunning swordcraft protected his right flank. For some minutes the clan held, but then the weight of the Aenir pushed them back. Magrig parried a wild cut from an axe-wielding warrior, countering with a swift thrust to the belly. He glanced back at the mountainside. It was clear. With no way of estimating the losses amongst the warriors, Magrig bellowed,
"Palades! Away!"
The survivors turned instantly, sprinting for the mountainside. Screaming their triumph, the Aenir swept after them. Halfway to the trees, Magrig glanced left and right. There were 500 still with him.
"Cut, cut, cut!"
he roared. At the sound of their battle cry, the Palades swung about and flung themselves on the pursuing warriors. In their eagerness to overhaul their enemy, the Aenir had lost the close compacted formation of the battle in the valley. The swiftest of them had outdistanced their comrades, and they paid with their lives.
"Palades, away!"
shouted Magrig once more, and the clansmen turned, racing for the relative haven of the trees. The Aenir surged after them. A leading warrior screamed suddenly, his fingers scrabbling at a black-shafted arrow that hammered into his throat. Another died, and another. The Aenir fell back as death hissed at them from the darkness of the woods. Within minutes, Magrig sent his men forward to catch up with the clan, then beckoned Intosh to join him. Together they eased their way through to the women archers, hidden by the timberline.
"Well done, Aduga," said Magrig, as a dark-haired woman rose up before him, bow in hand. "It was good thinking."
"It will not stop them for long. They'll outflank us."
"We'll be long gone by the time they do. They may be fine warriors, but they'll not catch us."
"That may be true, Hunt Lord, but where will we go?"
asked Aduga.
To the Farlan. You think we'll get a friendly welcome?
Asked Intosh.
Unless I'm mistaken, the Anir will be upon them before we arrive. Then why go there? My son Caswellan has a plan. We've spoken of it often, and at this moment it seems to be the best hope we have. We are making for Artaphos.
Magrig stepped forward, parted the bush screen, and gazed down upon the burning valley. The Anir was sitting on the hillside, just out of bowshot.
They're waiting for dawn, said Magrig, and that will not be long in coming. Let's away!
In the first valley of the Farlan, Caswellan was awakened before dawn by a frenzied hammering at his door. He rolled from the bed and ran downstairs. Outside was Taliesin. The old man, red-faced and wheezing, leaned on his oak staff. Catching his breath, he gripped Caswellan by the arm.
The Anir are upon us. We must move, now.
Caswellan nodded and shouted for Meg to dress Donal. Then he helped the druid into the kitchen, seating him by the hearth. Leaving him there, Caswellan lifted his warhorn from its place on the wall and stepped into the yard. Three times its eerie notes echoed through the valley. Then it was answered from a score of homes, and the clarion call was taken up, at last reaching the crofts of the outer valleys. Men and women streamed from their homes towards the games field, the men carrying bows, their swords strapped to their sides, the women ready with provision and blankets. Caswellan opened the wooden chest that sat against the far wall of the kitchen. From it he took a mail shirt and a short sword. Swiftly he pulled the mail shirt over his tunic and strapped the sword to his side. Taking the war horn, he tied its thong to his baldric and settled it in place.
How long do we have, Taliesin? Perhaps an hour, perhaps less.
Caswellan nodded. May came downstairs carrying Donal, and the four of them left the house. Caswellan ran on ahead to where hundreds of mystified clansmen were gathering. Leofas saw him and waved as Caswellan made his way to him.
What is happening, Caswellan?
The Anir are close. They've crossed the Farlan.
Who do you know this?
Taliesin. He's back there with Meg.
Caswellan helped the druid push through the crowd to make his way to the top of the small hill at the meadow known as Centre Field. The old man raised his arms for silence.
The Anir have tonight attacked the Hasten and the Palladies, he said. Soon they will be here.
How do you know this, old man?
Asked Campbell, striding up the hillside, his face crimson with anger.
A dream, perhaps? A druid's vision?
I know, Hunt Lord. That is enough.
Enough? Enough that you can tell us that 2 days' march away a battle is taking place? Are you mad?
I don't care how he knows, said Caswellan. We have less than an hour to move our people into the mountains. Are we going to stand here talking all night?
It is sheer nonsense,
shouted Campbell, turning to the crowd.
Why would the Anir attack? Are we expected to believe this old man? Can any of us see what is happening to the Palladies? And what if the Anir have attacked them? That is Palladies' business. I warned Magrig not to be bullheaded in his dealings with Asbadag. Now enough of this foolishness. Let's away to home and bed.
Wait! Shouted Caswellan, as men began to stir and move.
If the druid is wrong, we will know by morning. All we will have lost is one night on a damp mountainside. If he is right, we cannot defend this valley. If Magrick and Larrick have been crushed, as Taliesin says, then the Anir must attack the Farlan.
I'm with you, Caswellan,
shouted Leofas.
And I, called Bordrick.
Others took up the shout, but not all. Debate sprung up, arguments followed. In despair, Caswellan once more sounded his warhorn. In the silence that followed, he told them,
There is no more time to talk. I am leaving now, for the mountains. Those who wish to follow me, let them do so. To those who do not, let me say only that I pray you are right.
Campbell had already begun the long walk back to his home, and a score of others followed him. Caswellan led Meg and Taliesin down from the hill and through the crowd. Behind him came Leofas, Lane, Lennox, Baldric, and many more.
"Ah, well, what a night on the mountains," he heard someone say,
and the following crowd swelled. He did not look back, but his heart was heavy as he reached the trees. Of the 3,000 people in the first valley, more than 2,000 had followed him. Many of the rest still stood arguing in center field. Others were returning to their homes. It was at that moment that a ring of blazing torches flared up on the eastern skyline. Campbell, who was almost home, stopped and stared. The eastern mountainside was alive with armed men. His eyes scanned them. At the center on a black horse sat a man in heavy armor and horned helm. Campbell recognized the Aeneir lord and cursed him. "May the gods preserve us," whispered Agwain, who had run to join his father. Campbell turned to join him.
"Get away from here. No! Join Caswellan. Tell him I am sorry."
"Not without you, father."
Campbell slapped his face viciously.
"Am I not Hunt Lord? Obey me. Look after your sister."
On the hill above, Asbadag raised his arm, and the Aeneir charged, filling the night air with strident screams that pushed their hatred before them like an invisible wall. It struck Campbell to the heart, and he blanched.
"Get away!"
he yelled, pushing Agwain from him. Agwain fell back a step. There were so many things he wanted to say, but his father had drawn his sword and was running into the valley towards the Aeneir. Agwain turned away and ran towards the west, tears filling his eyes. In center field, hundreds of stragglers drew swords, ready to charge to the aid of their beleaguered kin. But Caswellan's warhorn stopped them.
"You can do nothing for them," he yelled in desperation. "Join us!"
The valley beyond was filled with Aeneir warriors. Fires sprang up in the nearby houses. The clansmen in the center field were torn between their desire to aid their comrades and their need to protect their wives and children beside them. The more immediate love tie took hold, and the crowd surged up the hillside. Campbell raced down the slope, sword in hand, blinking away the tears of shame filling his eyes. Memories forced their pictures to his mind. Unkind, ugly pictures. Magrig calling him a fool at the games. Taliesin's eyes radiating contempt. And way back, the cruelest of all, his father Pardris, telling him he wasn't fit to clean Caswellan's cloak. His feet pounded on the grass-covered slope. The Aeneir force had swung ponderously round like a giant horseshoe to begin the encirclement of the defenders who waited, grim-faced, swords in hand. Campbell increased his speed. Another 100 paces and he could die among the people he loved, the people he had betrayed with his stupidity. At least the enemy had not yet seen the exodus led by Caswellan. Breathless and near to exhaustion, Campbell joined the circle, standing beside the councillor Tesk.
"I am so sorry," said the Hunt Lord.
Tesk shrugged.
"We all make mistakes, Campbell, my lad. But be warned, I might not vote for you again."
The older man gently pushed Campbell back into the circle.
"Get your breath back, and join me in a little while."
Grinning, Tesk shifted his shield into place, transferring his gaze to the screaming horde almost upon them. He could see their faces now, feel their bloodlust strike him like a malignant breeze.
"The stars are out, Farlane," he yelled. "It's a fine night for dying."
The Aeneir broke upon them like waves upon a rock, and the slaughter began. But at first, it was the flashing blades of the Farland that ripped and tore at the enemy, and many were the screams of the Aeneir wounded and dying as they fell beneath the boots of their comrades. Campbell forced himself alongside Tesk, and all fear left the Hunt Lord. Doubts fled, shredding like summer clouds. He was calm at last, and the noise of the battle receded from him. A strange sense of detachment came upon him, and he seemed to be watching himself, cutting and slaying, and he heard the laughter from his own lips, as if from a stranger. All his life he had known the inner pain of uncertainty. Inadequacy hugged him like a shadow. Now he was free. An axe clove his chest, but there was no pain. He killed the axeman, and two others, before his legs gave way and he fell. He rolled to his back, feeling the warmth of life draining from the wound. He had finally succeeded. He knew that now. Without his sacrifice, Caswellan would never have had the time to escape. "I did something right, Father," he whispered.
"Bowman, to me!" shouted Caswellan.
Beside him, the silver-haired warrior Leofas stood with his sons Lane and Lennox.
"Leofas, lead the clan towards Atterforce. Throw out a wide screen of scouts, for before long the Anir will be hunting us. Go, now!"
The clan began to move on into the trees, just as the sun cleared the eastern peaks. Many were the backward glances at the small knot of fighting men ringed by the enemy, and the eyes that saw them burned with guilt and shame. 300 bowmen grouped themselves around Caswellan. Each bore 2 quivers containing 40 shafts. They spread out along the timberline, screened by bushes, thick gorse and heather. As the light strengthened, Caswellan watched the last gallant struggle of the encircled clansmen. He could see Campbell in with them, battling bravely, and some of the women had taken up swords and daggers. And then it was over. The sword ring fell apart, and the Anir swarmed over them, hacking and slashing until at last there was no movement from the defenders. Asbadag rode down the valley and removed his helm. He summoned his captains. Caswellan could not hear the commands he issued, but he could guess, for the eyes of the Anir turned west, and the army took up its weapons and ran towards the mountainside.
"Do not shoot until I do,"
he called to the hidden archers. Caswellan notched a shaft to the string as the Anir spread out along the foot of the slope. They advanced cautiously, many of them lifting the face guards of their helms the better to see the enemy. Caswellan grinned. He singled out a lean, wolfish warrior at the center of the advancing line. At 50 paces, he stood, in plain sight of the Anir, and drew back on the string. The shaft hissed through the air, hammering home in the forehead of the lead warrior. The Anir charged into a black-shafted wall of death. Hundreds fell within a few paces, and the charge faltered and failed, the enemy warriors sprinting back out of bowshot. Caswellan walked out into the open and sat down. Laying his bow beside him, he opened his hip pouch, removed a hunk of dark bread. This he began to eat, staring down at the milling warriors. Stung by the silent taunt of his presence, they charged once more. Calmly, Caswellan replaced the bread in his pouch, notched an arrow to his bow, loosed the shaft, and grinned as it brought down a stocky warrior in full cry, the arrow jutting from his chest. The Anir raced headlong into a second storm of shafts that culled their ranks and halted them. Caswellan, still shooting carefully, eased his way back into the bushes out of sight. The Anir fled once more, leaving a mound of their dead behind them. A young archer named Onik crept through the gorse to where Caswellan knelt. "We've all but exhausted our shafts," he whispered.
"Pass the word to fall back," said Caswellan.
In the valley, Asbadag walked among the bodies, stopping to stare down at Campbell's mutilated corpse.
"Removes a head and set it on a spear by his house,"
he told his son Tostig. The Anir lord unbuckled his breastplate, handing it to a grim-faced warrior beside him. Then he looked around, eyes raking the timber and the gaunt snow-covered peaks in the distance.
"I like this place," he said. "It has a good feeling to it." "But most of the Fallen escaped, Father," said Tostig. "Escaped to where? All that's out there is wilderness. By tonight, Drada will be here, having finished off the Hasten. Ongist will be harrying the Palades,
driving the survivors west into our arms. Once they are destroyed, we will take our men into the wilderness and finish the task. That's if Barca doesn't do it before we arrive. Barca? He's already in the west with 2,000 forest-trained warriors from the south. They call themselves Timber Wolves, and by Vartan, they are a match for any motley ragbag of stinking clansmen.
We took no women, complained Tostig. Most of the young ones killed themselves, bitches.
Drada will bring women, do not fret.
Asbadag began to move among the bodies once more, turning over the women and the young girls. Finally, he stood up and walked towards the house of Campbell.
Who are you seeking?
Asked Tostig, walking beside him.
Campbell's daughter, fair like gold and a spirited girl, unspoiled. I didn't like the way she looked at me. I told you to set Campbell's head on a spear.
Tostig blanched and fell back.
At once, father,
he stammered, running back to the bodies and drawing his sword. Dirk, of the Farlan, was known as a morose, solitary man. He had no friends and had chosen to spend his life in the high country west of the valley, where he built a small house of timber and grey stone and settled down to a life of expected loneliness. Dirk had always been a loner, and even as a child had kept himself apart from his fellows. It was not, he knew, that he disliked people, more that he was not good with words. He had never learned how to engage in light conversation. Crowds unnerved him, always had, and he avoided the dance and the feasts. Girls found him surly and uncommunicative. Men thought him standoffish and aloof. Year by year, the young clansman felt himself to be more and more remote from his fellows. Dirk found this hurtful, but knew that the blame lay within his own shy heart. But that first winter alone had almost starved him out until his neighbour Onik introduced him to Caswellan's night raids on bordering territories. In the beginning, Dirk had disliked Caswellan. It was easy to see why. They were night and day, winter and summer. Where Caswellan smiled easily and joked often, Dirk remained sullen with strangers and merely silent with companions. Yet, for his part, Caswellan seemed to enjoy Dirk's company, and little by little, his easy-going, friendly nature wore away the crofter's tough shell. Through Caswellan, Dirk met Corrine, the gentle child of the house, and in spite of himself, had fallen in love with her. In the most incredible slice of good fortune ever to befall the dark-bearded Highlander, Corrine had agreed to marry him. She transformed his dingy house into a comfortable home, and made his joy complete by falling pregnant in the first month of their marriage. With her, Dirk learned to laugh at his own failings, and his shyness retreated. At their marriage, he even danced with several of Corrine's friends. Laughter and joy covered him, drawing him back into the bosom of the clan, filling the empty places in his heart. 4 days ago, in her 8th month, Corrine had returned to the valley to have the babe in the home of Lassia, wife of the councillor Tesk, and midwife to the Farlan. But last night, Dirk had heard the warhorns blaring, and he had set out for the valley, filled with apprehension. In the first light of dawn, he had met the column of fleeing clansmen. Tesk was not among them. Caswellan had run forward to meet him, leading him away from the column. There Dirk heard the news that clove his heart like an axe blade. Tesk had died with Campbell and almost 800 others. With them was Corrine. Caswellan had seen her in the circle at the last, a hunting knife in her hand as the Aenir swept over them. Dirk did not ask why the rest of the clan had not raced back to die with them, although he dearly desired to.
Come with us, said Caswellan. I don't think that I will, my friend,
Dirk replied. Caswellan bowed his head, his green eyes sorrowful.
Do what you must, Dirk. The gods go with you. And with you, Caswellan.
You are the leader at last. I didn't want it.
No, but you're suited to it. You always were.
Now Dirk stood at the timberline, gazing down into the valley past the gutted homes and the Aenir tents, and on to the mounds of bodies in the centre of the field. He left the trees and began the long walk to his wife. Two Aenir warriors watched him come. They stood discarding their food and moved to intercept him. He was walking so casually, as if on a morning stroll. Could he be a messenger seeking peace, or one of Barsa's timberwolves dressed like a clansman?
"You there!" called the first, holding up his hand. "Wait!"
The hand vanished in a crimson spray as Dirk's sword flashed through the air. The return cut clove the man's neck. As he crumpled to the grass, the second drew his sword and leapt forward. Dirk ducked under a whistling sweep to gut the man. He walked on. Corinne had been no beauty, but her eyes were soft and gentle, and her mouth seemed always to be smiling, as if life held some secret enchantment, and she alone knew the mystery of it. In the valley, Aenir warriors were moving about, eating, drinking, and swapping stories. The invasion had gone well, and their losses had been few, save for the night before, against the ferocious clan Swordring. Who would have believed that a few hundred men and women could have put up such a struggle? Dirk moved on. No one stopped him, or even seemed to notice him as he walked to the mound of bodies and began to search for Corinne. He found her at the centre, lying beneath the headless corpse of Campbell. Gently he pulled her clear and tried to wipe the blood from her face, but it was dried hard and did not move. By now his actions had aroused the interest of five warriors who wandered forward to watch him. Dirk felt their eyes upon him, and he laid Corinne to the ground. He stood and walked towards them, his face expressionless, his dark eyes scanning them. They made no move towards their swords until he was almost upon them. It was as if his calm, casual movements cast an eldritch spell. Dirk's sword whispered from the scabbard. The spell broke. The Aenir scrabbled for their blades as Dirk's sword licked into them. The first fell screaming, the second tumbled back, his throat spraying blood into the air. The third died as he knelt staring at the gushing stump of his sword arm. The fourth hammered his sword into Dirk's side, then reeled away, dying, as the clansman shrugged off the mortal wound and backhanded a return cut to the man's throat. The fifth backed away, shouting for help. Dirk staggered and gazed down at the wound in his side. Blood flowed there, soaking his leggings and pooling at his feet. More Aenir warriors ran forward, stopping to stare at the dying clansman.
"Come on, then, you woman-killers! Face a man!"
he snarled. A warrior ran forward with sword raised. Dirk contemptuously batted aside his wild slash and reversed his own blade into the man's belly. The clansman began to laugh. Then suddenly he choked and staggered. Blood welled in his throat, and he spat it clear.
"You miserable horse-sons," he said. "Warriors, you're like a flock of sheep with fangs."
Dropping his sword, he turned and staggered back to Corinne's body. Slumping beside her, he lifted her head. A spear smashed through his back, and he arched upward violently. His vision swam. His last sight was Corinne's face.
"I'm so sorry," he said. "I should have been here."
Orsa gazed down at the body, then tore the spear from the clansman's back.
"He was a madman," murmured a warrior behind him. "He was a man," said Orsa,
turning and pushing his way through the throng. The Aenir milled round the corpses for a while, then drifted back to their forgotten meals.
"He was a fine swordsman," said a lean, wolfish warrior, dusting off the chicken leg he'd dropped in the dirt. "It was stupid," offered a second man, gathering up a bulging wineskin. "He was Barazak," said the first.
"Nonsense. We all know what happens to a berserker. He goes mad and attacks in a blind frenzy."
"No, that's what we do,"
The clansmen are different. They go cold and deadly, where we are hot. But the effect is the same. They don't care.
Taken to thinking now, Snorri.
This place makes you think, said Snorri. Just look around you. Wouldn't you be willing to die for a land like this?
I don't want to die for any piece of land. A woman, maybe not. Dirt, though.
Did you enjoy the clan woman you took last night?
Shut your stinking mouth.
Killed herself, I hear.
I said shut it.
Easy, Bemma. There's no need to lose your temper.
It's this place. It gets under my skin. I knew it wouldn't be easy. I felt it in my bones. Did you see the look in that clansman's eyes, like he thought we were nothing? A flock of sheep with fangs? You could laugh, but he had just slain 7 men. 7!
I know, said Snorri. It was the same last night with their sword ring. It was like hurling yourself against a cliff face. There was no give in them at all, no fear. That scout Ongis caught and blood-eagled? He didn't make a sound, just glared at us as we opened his ribs. Maybe they are not people at all.
What does that mean?
Asked Beymar, dropping his voice to a whisper. The witch woman, Agneta? She can turn men into animals. Maybe the clans are all animals turned into men.
That's stupid. They don't act like men,
argued Snorri.
Have you heard one clansman beg? Have you heard any tales of such a thing? They die like men, said Beymar.
I think they are more.
You've heard Aspedag's order? Not one man, woman, or child to be left alive, no slaves, all dead. Doesn't it strike you as strange?
I don't want to think about it. And I don't want to talk about it, muttered Beymar, hurling aside the wineskin.
Wolfmen, that's what they are,
whispered Snorri. Caswellan watched helplessly as Dirk walked back towards the valley. He knew the clansman was seeking death, and he could not blame him for it. Kareen had been his life, his joy, even as Maeg meant everything to Caswellan. The clan column moved on, and Caswellan took his place at the head alongside Leofas. Crofters from outlying areas joined the exodus as the day wore on, and many were the questions levelled at the new lord. Where were they going? What would they do? What had happened to one man's sister, another's brother? Why did they not turn and fight? Why had the Aenir attacked? Where was Campbell? Who elected Caswellan? The clansman lost his temper before dusk, storming away from the column and running quickly to the top of a nearby hill. Around him the dying sun lit the valleys of the Farlan, bathing them in blood. Caswellan sank to the ground, staring out over the distant peaks of Hydruin.
It's all a lie, he said softly.
Then he began to chuckle.
You've lived a damn lie.
Poor Campbell. Poor lonely Campbell.
You should not have feared me, cousin,
Caswellan told the gathering darkness.
Your father knew. He was wiser than you.
The night before, the young Caswellan had left his foster father's house for the last time. Padres had taken him to the northern meadow, and there presented him with a cloak, a dagger, and 2 gold pieces.
I will not lie to you, Caswellan,
Padres had told him, his keen eyes sorrowful.
You've been a disappointment to me. I've raised you like my own son, and you have great talents. But you are not worthy. You have a sharp mind, a good brain, and a strong body. You will prosper. But you are not worthy. There is in you a fear that I cannot fathom. Outwardly, you are brave enough, and you take your beatings like a man. But you are not clan. You don't care. What is it that you fear?
I fear nothing, Caswellan had told him.
Wrong. Now I see 2 fears, the one that you hide, and now the fear of showing it. Go in peace, Caswellan of the Farlan.
You were right, Padres, Caswellan whispered to the sky. This is what I feared. Chains,
questions, responsibilities. Giving judgment over land disputes, settling rows over cattle or sheep, or thefts or wayward wives and wandering husbands, sentencing poachers, granting titles, deciding on the suitability of couples in love, and granting them the right to wed. Every petty problem, a double-edged dagger. And so he avoided the elections. But what had it gained? The Farlane invaded and thousands dead throughout Druin. And what price the future? He swore as he heard footsteps approaching. Leofas slumped down beside him, breathing hard.
No sign of pursuit,
said the old warrior. Good.
Talk, boy. Shed the burden.
It would shed the burden if you agreed to lead.
We've been over that before. I'm not the man for it.
Neither am I.
Whisht, lad. Don't talk nonsense. You're doing fine. So far, we've saved the greater number of our cousins, and with luck there's another 2,000 crofters who would have heard the horns and taken to the hills.
Damn you, old man. I never gave you much of an argument before, and I should have. You've been on the council since before I was born. You're respected. Everyone would follow you. You're the natural choice. What right have you to shirk your responsibility?
None whatsoever, Caswellan, and I cannot be accused of it. A man needs to know his strength if he is to prosper, and his weaknesses if he is to survive. I know what you are going through, but believe me, you are the best man we have. I'll grant that you would make a bad hunt lord. You don't have the application, but this is war. With luck, it will be a short, sharp exercise, and you're the man to plan it. Think of it as a giant raid. Ye gods, man, you are good enough at that.
But it isn't a raid, snapped Caswellan. One mistake and we lose everything.
I didn't say it was easy. That's true enough. You have faith in Taliesin, do you not?
Yes.
Well, he said you were the only man capable of pulling a victory from this catastrophic beginning. And I believe him.
I wish I had your faith.
It's because you don't that convinces me,
said Leofas, slapping him on the shoulder.
I'm going to say this once, boy, for I'm not given to compliments. There's a nobility in you, and a strength you've not begun to touch. Rescuing Galen showed it to me. It was a fine, bonny thing. But more than that, I remember when we hunted the beast. You lifted Campbell that night when his fear for his son threatened to unman him, and among men who despised you. It was you they followed when you walked to the north. When the queen was dying and delirious, you gave her words of comfort. You it was who planned the victory of the games, and you again who brought us out of the valley. So don't sit here bemoaning your fate. You are where you should be. Warlord of Farlane. Do I make myself clear?
I should have spoken to you 10 years ago, said Caswellan. Maybe I would have been different.
10 years ago you wouldn't have listened. Whoring and stealing filled your mind.
Good days, though, said Caswellan, grinning.
Don't say it as though you're letting me into a secret. I was whoring and stealing before you were born, and probably making a better job of it.
Galen awoke, rolling to his back and rubbing his eyes. The night was silent, save for the movement of bats in the trees above him and the skittering sound of badgers in the undergrowth off to the left. These were sounds he knew well. But something else had pierced his dreams, bringing him to wakefulness. His mind was hazy, confused. It had seemed as if horns were blowing far away, whispering in the night breeze. But now there was silence as Galen sat up and looked around him. Renda was gone, hunting his supper, and the fire had died down within its circle of rocks. Galen added fuel, more for light than heat. As the blaze flared, he pushed back his blanket and stood up, stretching the muscles of his back. He was hungry. The sky was lightening, and the dawn was not far off. Gathering his bow and quiver, he made his way to the edge of the wood, looking down onto a gently sloping field, silver in the waning moonlight. Upon it were scores of rabbits nibbling at grass and clover. Galen settled down on his knees and strung the bow. He then selected an arrow and notched it to the string.
Spotting a buck, some 20 paces distant, he drew and loosed the shaft. As the buck fell, the other rabbits disappeared at speed. Returning to the fire, he skinned the beast, gutting and slicing it for the pot. Renda loped through the bushes, jaws bloody, and squatted down beside him, waiting expectantly for the remains. Galen threw the offal to the hound, who set to work on his second meal of the night. As dawn light seeped into the sky, Galen found himself thinking of the queen beyond. Often her face would come to him, sometimes in dreams, but more often as he went about the chores of the day. She had died for him, for them, and Galen wished with all his heart that he could have repaid her. And what did she mean when she promised to come again? By mid-morning, Galen and Renda were picking their way down a wooded slope alongside a tumbling stream. Every 40 or 50 paces the water hissed over rocky falls, gushing at ever-increasing speeds towards the valley below. Birds sang in the trees, and crimson flowers bloomed from the water. Every now and then, as they came to a break in the trees, Galen stopped and gazed on the mountains, still snow-capped, like old men in a line. Galen knew he should be feeling guilty about his leisurely pace and the wide western swing he was making, for there was plenty of spring work back home. But after the winter cooped up in the valley, he needed the solitude. A woman's scream pierced the glade. Renda's head came up, a deep growl starting in his throat. Galen flashed his hand up, palm outwards, and the dog fell silent. The scream came from the right, beyond a thicket of gorse. Galen eased his hunting knife into his hand, released his pack and bow from his shoulders, and moved forward silently. Renda padded beside him. Once in the thicket, other noises came to them. The rending of cloth, and slapping sounds as if open-handed blows were being struck. Creeping forward, bent double, Galen came to the edge of the thicket. Three Aenir warriors had pinned a young girl to the ground. Two held her arms, the third crouched over her, slashing her clothes with a knife and ripping them from her. Galen calmed the dog and waited. He couldn't see the girl's face, but from the clothes, she was Farlan. The Aenir stripped her naked, then one forced her legs apart, dropping his hand to loosen his breeches. As he did so, Galen pointed to the warrior holding the girl. "Kill!" he hissed. Renda leapt forward, covering the ground in three bounds, snarling ferociously. The three whirled at the sound, dragging their knives clear. Renda's great jaws closed upon the throat of his victim, the Aenir's neck snapping with a hideous crack. Galen, long hunting knife in hand, was just behind the dog. He hurdled the beast, batting aside a wild slash from the second Aenir, then himself backhanded a cut across the man's face. The warrior's cheek blossomed red and he fell back, dropping his knife. Galen threw himself forward to plunge his own blade through the man's leather jerkin, up under the ribs, seeking the heart. The man's eyes opened in shock and pain. Galen twisted the blade to free it from the suction of the man's body and tore it loose, kicking him away. Spinning, he was just in time to parry a thrust from the third warrior, who aimed a vicious cut at his head. Galen ducked beneath it, stepping inside to hammer the knife into the man's groin. The Aenir screamed and fell. Galen dragged the knife clear, punching it to the man's throat and cutting off his screams. Renda, still growling, tore at his victim, though the man was long dead. "Home!" hissed Galen. In the following silence, he listened intently. Satisfied the Aenir were alone, he ran to the girl. It was Deva, her face bruised and swollen, her lips cut and bleeding. She was unconscious. Galen gathered what remained of her clothes and lifted the girl to his shoulder. Then he made his way back through the thicket to his pack and labored on up the slope, keeping to the rocky paths and firmer areas that would leave less sign of his passing. His breathing was ragged as he reached the highest point of the slope, cutting into a sheltered glade where he lowered Deva to the ground. She was breathing evenly. Her shirt was in tatters, and he threw it to one side. Her skirt had been ripped in half. Removing it, he spread the cloth and sliced an opening in the center. Sheathing his knife, he lifted the girl to a sitting position and put the skirt over her head, widening the slash until the garment settled over her shoulders like a cape that fell to her knees. He tore her shirt into strips and fashioned a belt which he tied round her waist. Then he laid her back.
"Stay,"
he ordered Renda, and the hound settled down beside the girl. Galen gathered up his bow and quiver and retraced his steps to the slope, crouching in the undergrowth, eyes searching the trail. There were so many questions. Why were the Aenir so far into the Farlan? What was Diva doing alone in the wilderness? What manner of men were these warriors, who dressed like foresters and carried hunting knives like the clans? Had the war begun, or were they merely scouts? How many more were searching these woods? He could answer none of the questions. He had been lucky today, waiting until the men's lust was at its height before launching an attack, that once the enemy discovered the bodies, they would be on his trail like wolves after a wounded deer. More than luck would be needed to survive from now on, he knew. He was at least 2 days from the valley, but if the war had begun, there was no point going east. If it had not, there was little point heading for Atafos, a day or more to the northeast. Down the slope, he saw a flash of movement and drew back into the bushes. A man appeared, then another, then a file of warriors bearing bows. They did not seem to be hunting a trail, but if they kept moving along the track, they would find the bodies. Galen waited until the file had passed, counting them, despair growing as the figure topped 100. This was no scouting party. Pulling back out of sight, he ran to the glade, kneeling over Deva, lifting her head and lightly stroking her face. She came awake with a start, a scream beginning as his hand clamped over her mouth. "Be silent, Deva. It is Galen," he hissed. Her eyes swiveled to him, and she blinked and nodded. He removed his hand. "The Aenir?" she whispered. "Dead, but more are coming, and we must move. Can you run?" She nodded, and he helped her to her feet. Hoisting his pack, he gathered up the remains of her clothing and bade her wait for him. He moved east for 200 paces, crossing the stream, leaving his track on a muddy bank, and looping a torn fragment of Davis' shirt over a gorse bush. Satisfied with the false trail, he turned west again, moving more carefully over the rocks and firm ground, until he rejoined Deva in the glade. "Let's go," he said, heading for Atafos. They made almost half a mile when the horn sounded, echoing eerily in the mountains around them. "They found the bodies," he said grimly. "Let's push on." Throughout the long afternoon, Galen led them ever higher into the mountains, stopping often to study the back trail and keeping ever under cover. Deva stumbled after him, still in shock after her narrow escape, and yet awed by the authoritative manner in which Galen was leading. There was no panic in him, nor yet any sign of fear. He was, she realized, not without shock, a clansman. And he had killed 3 Aenir warriors. She was sorry to have missed that event. Towards dusk, Galen found a secluded hollow off the trail, and he dumped his pack and sat down. He stayed there silently for some minutes, ignoring the girl. Then he stood and returned to the trail, crouching to scan the mountainside. There was no sign of pursuit. He waited until it was too dark to see any distance, then returned to the hollow. Deva was bathing her face with water from his canteen, and he squatted beside her. "How are you faring?" he asked.
"Well, are they close?"
"I can see no one, but that tells us nothing. They are woodsmen. They could be anywhere."
"Yes."
"What were you doing in the mountains?" he asked her.
"I had to visit my Uncle Lars, who has a croft cabin south of here. I went with Lorraine. We were coming home when we saw the Aenir and both ran. I hid in the woods. I don't know what happened to Lorraine. Most of the night I listened for them, but I heard nothing. This morning I tried to get back to the valley, but they were waiting for me. I got away once, but they caught me back there, where you found me."
"It's an invasion," said Galen.
"But why would they do such a thing?"
"I don't know, Deva. I don't believe they need a reason to fight. Rest now."
"Thank you for my tunic," she whispered, leaning in to kiss his cheek.
"I could do no better," he stammered.
Reaching past her, He pulled his blanket roll from the pack. "Wrap yourself. It will be a chill night and we can afford no fire." "Galen?" "Yes." I thank you for saving my life. Thank me when we reach safety, if there is such a place still." She watched the darkness swallow him, knowing he would spend the night on the edge of the trail. Renda settled down beside her, and she snuggled into his warm body. Galen awoke just before dawn, coming out of a light doze in his hiding place by the trail's edge. He yawned and stretched. The path below was still clear. Rounding the bushes, he stopped, jolted by a heel print on the track not 10 paces from where he had slept. The track was fresh. Swiftly he searched the ground. He found another print, and a third alongside it. 2 men, and they were ahead of him. Ducking once more, he re-entered the glade, waking Deva and rolling his blanket. Taking up his pack, he unstrapped his bow and strung it. Glancing round, he saw that Renda had gone a-hunting. "We have a problem," he told the girl. "They are ahead of us," he nodded. "Only 2 of them. Scouts. They passed in the night." "Then give me a bow. My marksmanship is good, and you'll need your hands clear for knife work." He handed her the weapon without hesitation. All clanswomen were practiced with the bow, and Deva had the reputation of being better than most. Slowly they made their way north and east, wary of open ground, until at last the trees thinned and a gorse-covered slope beckoned beyond. It stretched for some 400 paces.
"You could hide an army down there," whispered Deva, crouching beside him in the last of the undergrowth before the slope.
"I know, but we have little choice. The main force is behind us. They have sent these scouts ahead to cut us off. If we remain here, the main body will come upon us. We must go on."
"You go first. I'll wait here. If I spot movement, I'll signal."
"Very well, but don't shoot until you are sure of a hit."
Biting back an angry retort, she nodded. What did he think she was going to do? Shoot at shadows? Galen left the cover of the trees and moved slowly down the slope, tense and expectant. Deva scanned the gorse, trying not to focus on any one point. Her father had taught her that movement was best seen peripherally. A bush to the right moved, as if a man was seeing through it. Then her attention was jerked away by a noise from behind, and she turned. 100 paces back along the trail, a man had fallen, and his comrades were laughing at him. They were not yet in sight, but would be in a matter of moments. She was trapped. Fighting down panic, she notched an arrow to the bow. Galen reached the bottom of the slope and glanced back. Deva lifted both hands, pointing 1 index finger left, the other right. Then she jerked her thumb over her shoulder. Galen cursed and moved. He broke into a lunging run for the gorse, angling to the right, his knife in his hand. Surprised by the sudden sprint, the hidden archer had to step into the open. His bow was already bent. Deva drew back the bowstring to nestle against her cheek, releasing her breath slowly. She calmed her mind and sighted on the motionless archer. Galen threw himself forward in a tumbler's roll as the man released his shaft. It whistled over his head. Deva let fly, the arrow flashing down to thud into the archer's chest. The man dropped his bow and fell to his knees, clutching at the shaft. Then he toppled sideways to the earth. Coming out of his roll, Galen saw the man fall. The second Denir, a huge man with a braided yellow beard, hurled his bow aside and drew his own hunting knife. He leapt at the clansman, his knife plunging towards Galen's belly. Galen dived to the left, and the Aeneas blade raked his ribs. Rolling to his feet, Galen launched himself at the warrior, his shoulder cannoning into the man's chest. Off balance, the Aeneas fell, Galen on top of him. The blonde warrior tried to rise, but Galen slammed his forehead against the Aeneas nose, blinding him momentarily. As the man fell back, Galen rolled onto the warrior's knife arm and sliced his own blade across the bearded throat. Blood bubbled and surged from the gaping wound, drenching the clansman. Pushing the body under thick gorse, Galen rolled to his feet and ran back to the first man. Deva was already there, struggling to pull the body out of sight into the bushes. Together they made it with scant moments to spare. Huddled together over the corpse, Galen put his arm round Deva, drawing her close as the Aeneas force breasted the slope.
If they find the other body, we're finished, he said. His knife was in his hand, and he knew, with bleak certainty, that he would cut her throat.